Hello, Catherine. Is it recording for you? I think it is.
Yes.
Okay, great. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another podcast with the ICC. This is your host, Daniel Bagheri. I am here with Dr. Catherine, director of First People Studies at Concordia University, and a counselor, social worker, activist. And where to begin? And you have so many different publications, your most recent publications being Calling Our Families Home, Métis Experience with Child Warfare, Belonging Métis, and many, many others. Hi, Kathy, how are you?
Hi, very good, thank you.
May I open this space for you to just give a little introduction about yourself?
Yes, sure. Yeah, so I have a Cree name, which is Kinuiskweyu, which means Golden Eagle Woman. And I am a member of the Métis Nation of Canada. I have Cree and Gwich'in ancestry, and my mom comes from the community of Fort Chipewyan in northern Alberta.
Wow.
So yes, my day job is at the university and running the First People Studies program, and I have a small private practice in counseling and participate in various healing initiatives for mostly in the Indigenous community locally, but sometimes internationally or in other projects. For example, right now I'm on the Yukon Task Force for developing policy how to handle the situation of missing and murdered women
Wow.
in that territory. Yeah.
Wow. Catherine, that's amazing. Thank you for being on the program with us. We really do appreciate it. And the missing Indigenous girls and women, it's very much an ongoing issue. And I think you made a point that many thousands of women and girls go missing or murdered annually.
Yes, and the more I look into it, I see that it's also happening in the United States as well as Canada. And it's kind of an invisibilized issue, probably because in the dominant society, Indigenous women aren't particularly valued. Or going back to that colonial thinking, the role of Indigenous men to the settler state was to provide labor with their bodies, and the role of Indigenous women was to provide basically, food and cleaning and services, including the, hypersexualization and the, using the dehumanization process and using people just to serve the upper class in the settler society. That's been the nature of the colonial project, as well as forcibly moving people off lands so that mining could take place. So it's part of that whole colonial process, which you and I have talked about a bit earlier.
And I really do appreciate that pointing issue pointing I'm pointing these issues out because at least in our community, there's a bit of confusion. Right. When we talk about notions of coloniality, well, what do people would say? Oh, this was in the past. Colonization happened in the past, and we're past this point now. We live in a society where everything's egalitarian, everything is democratic. However, I think there's a distinction, and you were hinting at it. There's a distinction between coloniality and colonialism, especially when it comes to First Nations people of color in the United States, for example. You have redlining. The isolation of different groups of people based on their social, economic, political classes. Can you elaborate on that a little bit, just so that our audience could understand, when we're talking about continued discrimination, especially towards First Nation peoples, this is an ongoing part of an ongoing problem with coloniality versus colonialism.
Yeah, I guess I could just explain a bit by saying that, Indigenous people are nations. They're sovereign nations, and they are all across Northern Turtle Island. I mean, if we're talking about what we call Canada. And these communities were largely disrupted through industrial projects of various states. And these projects tend to have pushed people off the land or reduced their land base. But at the same time, the government, say the government of Canada, for example, mm-hmm. don't value these communities for the people that live there and don't resource them. So many people from the north and Quebec don't have adequate food or clean water or health care. They don't have the things they need to live. They don't have sure. good schools. Young people have been complaining about that, you know, saying we have a school room that's cold and right. there's rats running around in it and it's not safe. So why is it? I mean, this is one aspect, I think, of the colonial mentality, is that our governments don't properly take care of these communities from which they have extracted That's so right. much and built careers. Every time we have a new, you know, mental health project, or it could be an industrial project, people go into the communities to work, to provide services. And some people build their careers on the suffering of Indigenous people. So we've become an industry. Indigenous children are an industry around, like, the child welfare system. It should be the child removal mm-hmm. system. Mm-hmm. And so I apply that economic argument. Every time there's a new program, who benefits? And it really right. isn't Indigenous people. It's kind of that global, developmental aid model. You send a bunch of people, so-called experts, in to do their work, and then they leave when the little project's over, and they don't leave any infrastructure behind, but they leave a mess behind and people that are continuing to live without the things they need, the basic things to have a decent standard of living. So I hope that touches on the question you asked. Yeah,
this is really wonderful. And of course, your work, your writing is rooted in a wealth of experience. I mean, firsthand experience. I mean, you yourself, based on the article, some of your articles I've read, mm-hmm. has had experience, growing up in these areas that were severely neglected. I mean, your family even. And mm-hmm. these issues impact people of color, Indigenous people, on a bodily, on the level of the body even. You, at some point you mentioned that, for instance, your family, they were, on a uranium site, which is, I mean, that just blew my mind.
Yes, it's true what you say. The social justice issues that some people intellectualize about, they actually live in our body. That's been the cost of developing that knowledge. And so that's why I think that, like, one reason why people should actually listen to activists and Indigenous people is because we didn't open a bunch of textbooks and just get theoretical knowledge, or right. as some professors would like to think, oh, we took a course in political science and then we learned how to do this or that. No, we learned through living it and experiencing the fight and the injustice. And Absolutely. If you want to have a peek into that, you can look at the Wet'suwet'en community right now, which is mm-hmm. continually getting attacked by the RCMP and industry trying to get in and build their pipeline, and the community, defending it with their bodies. And it's their right. land. It's a sovereign area. It's their land. And it's being invaded. And so that's problematic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're trying to pass the pipeline, the polluting oil pipeline through their territory,
of course. Yeah.
So having said that, I also, you briefly touched on this problematic side of development. I mean, this neoliberal approach to development, where it just developed because of industry. Yeah. Marketing ploy, but you approach healing, or let's say social issues, rooted in experience. You have a very particular approach, especially when it comes to Métis women, First Nation women, and racialized people, from a very powerful position of experience and connectivity to the community. And you talk about how these issues are not just in isolation, but there are social issues. So can you give us a look inside of your therapeutic space, even if that makes sense?
Sure. And I guess I would just start by saying that when I work in a space, I acknowledge that I'm there because that line of my ancestors survived. Mm. And I was nurtured as a person to come and do this work. So I'm not alone in the room, even when I go in. And so we set up the space to make it safe. And that could be through, a little smudge ceremony or just an intention or a prayer. Yes. So it is a spiritual space in the sense of anywhere where a human being is experiencing growth in terms of identifying and releasing their pain and suffering, being witness to that, and having enough safety in order to express oneself that way, that's a sacred space. So we have to, people that do this work need to set that up with intentions. And then someone is invited into the space. And now it often happens on Zoom. And so part of my therapeutic work has been with a little team made up of Alan Wade and Linda Coates and Shelley Dean. So the four of us now, we're the Center for Response-Based Practice. And this work is about helping people recover from violence and adversity in a spirit of dignity and social justice. So when people have been harmed, one of the things that happens that isn't identified in mainstream psychology is that people have been humiliated by their oppressor or by their perpetrator. And part of the healing work is reaffirming their dignity as a person. This is like a social interactional project. It's not something that happens in the brain necessarily. It does happen there, but it happens in your body and in your heart and in your memory and lots of places. Like, it's a holistic process, right, of acknowledging, yes, you were wrongly hurt. That wasn't your fault. People should have helped you more, and they didn't. They left you alone to deal with this difficult problem. And these are the things that you did to get through that situation. And so with that concept of reaffirming dignity and addressing the humiliation and the wrongfulness of that, we basically will walk a person through a process if they want to, where they talk a little bit about what happened to them, like what was done to them, paying attention to the language we use, because we should use active language with subjects, like with people, not just like a hit happened or there was a disaster. No, in most interaction, there are human beings involved. And just as an aside, when you read the literature of the Canadian government on things like what they call residential school or some of these disastrous events, they actually crafted them. But if you read like former Prime Minister Harper's apology, you see the use of very passive language. Like, it was a sad chapter in history, but there were no perpetrators. Mm-hmm. And that is the kind of language that does not help people heal. Okay. What helps people heal is when the person doing the harm takes responsibility and tries to make amends, make repair, and show that I'm not going to do that again, so your friends and family can be safe. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of context we need. So we look at what the event was, like who did what to whom, and how the person who's sitting in front of me, how did they respond, like in the moment? How did they first notice that things weren't safe anymore, or that they felt threatened, or that there was some kind of danger? So really picking up on the person's inner radar, their perceptions, everything they know about safety and their sense of integrity. And so what did they do? We explore that. And how did you know to do that in that moment? And, for example, I asked one woman how she got away when some somebody was strangling her. And she said, I didn't really think about it, but I just lifted my hand up and pushed that person's hand away. And it worked. And I said, okay, what hand did you use? Because we always go in for these details. And yes. They said, oh, well, I used my left hand because I had earlier broken my right wrist playing softball. And so that hand is much weaker. So I said, so if you'd use the other hand, you might not have gotten away. And so we just like spent a minute just acknowledging the wisdom of the body, like you knew without thinking to use this left hand. And yeah, and that helped me and I got away and, you know, it worked out all right for me. But so that kind of knowledge that we all have about ourselves and our bodies, and then we go take it to the next circle, which is who saw, who knew that was happening, like looking at what we call the social responses. And that's the part that's really the most crucial in the healing or recovery process. If a person feels like people saw or they knew they were being hurt and they came in and they helped and they stopped the violence and they helped to make the person safe and they helped to restore that person's sense of worth as a human being, like telling them like this wasn't your fault, that was really terrible, but look at you, that was really clever what you did there. Like, you know, in cases of domestic violence, some little kids know that they can take a cell phone and they can dial 911 and then throw the phone into the next yard and that the police or the ambulance will come. Like, people know things like that when they live in danger. And I know you know, people as yourself, you come from countries where there has been war, like people get attuned to safety and knowing what you have to do in certain situations. And there are a lot of people in Canada that live in households where they are being harmed on a daily basis. There's still a lot of forms of violence, right? So then we look at how did that person respond to the social responders? And if people really helped, then the response would be, oh, I'm going to send them a thank you card or I'm going to bake them a cake. But unfortunately for Indigenous and racialized people here in Canada, most of the responses they get are negative. They involve racism and they involve bad treatment by services. Could be in, you know, hospitals or, you know, just with neighbors in any of our systems, in the justice system. Most of the time, the response is negative and unhelpful. And that's what perpetrates the suffering of the person. Mm. It's not that they're traumatized by the initial event, as Western psychology would tell us.
Right.
It's because all these other people knew that this was going on and nobody came to help us. Like that kind of thing. That's what creates the suffering. I mean, look at Romeo Dallaire in Canada. After being in Rwanda and asking Canada and the world for help because there was going to be a genocide and nobody came to help. Like that is what pained him so much, in addition to the events that he was witness to, right?
And that's fascinating. And this bringing it back to social response. So the perpetrators of the event on one side, and on the other side, you have social responses that could either perpetuate the violence or help heal it in many cases. So would you consider an atmosphere that's, let's say, completely biased against a culture, against a people, where you have 24/7, say, news media or 24/7 media that is focused on a group of people in particular, and all that news media does is perpetuate negativity, and this group of people, all they are witnessing are essentially, you might call, negative social responses. Would that have deep psychological impact on those people?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it creates a lot that they need to respond to, right? So one really poignant and recent example is around the situation of the so-called residential schools. And I say it like that because I think the government made up that term. This is a residential school. It's a euphemism for a prison camp or a resocialization camp for Indigenous children. So it's not a school. Just be clear about that. And so recently, there's been different waves of acknowledgement of what happened in that history, but elders and the generations who were sent to those institutions when they were little children, they started talking about it publicly in different waves. So in the first wave, they were treated so badly, even by CBC Radio, who called these allegations or like, you're saying this happened, but they wouldn't acknowledge that it was actually a national plan. And so recently, an elder can talk about that they were sent there and that terrible things may have been done to them. And the response they get by society, especially by psychologists, I have to say, and there's quite a lot in Quebec, say to them, oh, what, can't you just get over that? That happened a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And that kind of ignorance is shocking because it didn't really happen a long time ago because the That's social right. responses are ongoing. Mm-hmm. And so if this is one person I had worked with, if you were sent there and then suddenly, you know, you grew up and you became 65 years old and you try to get your pension from the Canadian government and you're rejected and they say you don't exist because some priest changed your real name and gave you a name like, you know, Bob Smith or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's almost like they named these Indigenous children after the slave masters, like in the United States. So you got a kind of a Euro-Canadian name. Right. And so this woman was trying to get her pension. They said, you don't exist, because they had changed her name, but nobody had put in an official record. So she has to go through, a mountain of bureaucratic mess in order to assert that she really exists. So that happens now. And it means she doesn't have the money that she deserves now, and she can't buy presents for her grandchildren now. So these things, they happen today. And like you were saying about the body, negative things can happen to us. Like, for example, in some places in these institutions, they did starvation experiments on these children. And then we know about epigenetics and how, yes. you know, your body can respond later on because of that situation. And so you have health problems today. Mm-hmm. And then you go to a doctor and you get blamed for it yourself, as if you did something wrong or you're too obese or this or that. You know what I mean? It's yeah. like these layers of victim blaming. So that's one example of it. And then a lot of people who don't understand, they just say, oh, that was so long ago. How come you can't get over that?
So now, correct me if I'm wrong, but for many racialized communities and especially Indigenous communities, like emotional illnesses in general are part of a bigger social systematic issue. Not addressing the social aspect, in other words, doesn't really address those experiences that person is having. So how do we facilitate this social healing in our communities, especially, for instance, in our communities? Well, we've experienced genocide as well at the hands of British colonials. Something like 10 million people, half of the country's population, were starved to death, right? Yeah. And, you know, that did happen a while ago, but for some reason, I feel like that I can still feel it, deep down. You know, I feel like I've been wrong tremendously. Yeah. And the fact that that issue was hidden for decades, I mean, it's just recently that somebody has published a book on it.
Wow.
It not only baffles my mind, but it's also like pouring salt on the wound, you know? And so there's two ways of going about it. You could either let these things create violence in you. And by the way, I see much of the violence that we experience in our part of the world due to issues of coloniality and not, like you said, not being acknowledged. Those pains and suffering of colonialism, coloniality and genocide not being acknowledged, which really opened my eyes in a lot of different ways. But so I guess my question is, instead of, instead of expressing those, or like how do we facilitate the healing space so it doesn't come out as a violent reaction, or it doesn't come out violently or destructively? How do we facilitate a healing space for our community as a whole? Now I know and that's why we're fascinated with the experience. I mean, I work with indigenous peoples. I'm an indigenous person's rights advisor. I work in Honduras and Guatemala with indigenous nations. And I found that working with indigenous people really helps me process my own pains and suffering and trauma, let's say.
Yeah, so one of the things that would have happened for you and people like you is you don't have as many relatives. Your family size is smaller because they killed so many people, right? And they took your land and they took your, you know, your possessions, right? The colonizers. So, right. So just to have that acknowledged is important, like for people to have compassion for that happened to you. And I don't, you know, it's so strange. Western psychology is one arm of the colonial project. Mm-hmm. And if you read books on counseling, like going back to the 1850s up to, you know, today, you will seldom find a book that talks about the healing power of justice. Because justice is one of the main, like I would call it, like the healing medicines or ingredients. And so many people are denied that justice, and it can take many forms. And so we can create that through conversations in our own community, through mutual care and the showing of empathy and compassion for things that happened, but without comparing tragedies, like, oh, that happened right. to you, but what happened to me was even worse. Not about that. It's just to acknowledge and listen. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, like in many Indigenous processes and circles that I've been in, after somebody tells their story, either individually with witnesses or lots of people talking in a circle, there's a process where everyone goes around and gives everybody either a hug or a handshake. And some people are given blankets. Like if somebody shares a testimony about what happened to them, they're wrapped in a blanket, and then people, you know, acknowledge them, and they really thank them for sharing because they know the sensitivity and the delicacy, the fragility that can happen in those moments of making yourself vulnerable, because you don't really know how people are going to respond. And if they respond badly, it can really put you in a downward spiral. So that's why the safety is important. So I think justice, the things that we can do for each other, and also collective mourning, like grief as a collective project. And that's why I think that vigils are important.
Right.
And processes where we come together, and often, you know, we greet each other, then there would be a purpose, we would do some action, and then we would eat together and talk and visit. And, you know, in some ways it's a ritual, and even people that go to churches, that's the ritual. You come into a space, you greet people, you listen to some talk or some content, and then you have tea and cookies together, and then you go home. And you know, it's just that the structure of that ritual is really important. And so we can design the content like you're doing for your conference, like what are we going to focus on, what are we going to share and talk about. And it really is important to create the small group process, so we deliver a big content like in a conference, and then put people in small groups or small rooms and ask them a question like, what are you going to do in 2022 to contribute to social justice or to collective care? And they just talk about that for 10 or 15 minutes and then come back and they feel like they've had a process, not just being talked at. And then we do something together with food. So that's a process of community care.
Community, collectivity, that's really interesting and that's really important. And, you know, that came through really strongly through your work. Now, Catherine, I know you have to go. And this is, I could just talk to you for hours. I have to look at the time here. But I just want to, you know, just to bring it to some kind of a closing, you talk about this metaphor, importance of metaphor, but specifically use the metaphor of the pilgrimage. And you also talked a lot about the land itself being, you know, of importance to us when it comes to healing.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe can you elaborate on this? And maybe in closing, just give us some points or give us some suggestions on how as racialized immigrant communities who derive from, you know, issues with oppression and whatnot could connect with, you know, First Nations communities who represent, like you said, this land that we live in, you know, and we acknowledge the First Nations. We could live in community with the First Nation.
Mm-hmm.
And just can you elaborate on that? I know it's all a little too much, but just okay. The matter for themselves, how to process healing in us as a community, as a racialized
Okay, first of all, let me say that the metaphor of trauma is a really unhelpful metaphor because it hides the perpetrator. It collapses things like an earthquake together with somebody actually, you know, hitting you with a stick or denying your rights or something.
Right.
So trauma, it refers in a hazy way to having brain damage. Like this bad thing happened to you and now you have brain damage and it means you're not fit. And that these weird things are going on in your brain. And the only way you can really heal from that, according to the folks there, is through CBT, like cognitive behavioral mm-hmm. therapy and meditation. And so if those are the only healing forms, then I think we're sunk. But so I don't use that metaphor. I might use it as an adjective. So that was a traumatizing experience because it's in the common language. But there are lots of other poetic metaphors that you can use. Think of the poets. They talk about suffering. They talk about having a broken heart. They talk about feeling blue, you know, like we all have poetry. And I believe you have the beautiful, like Rumi is, you know, from your culture. Yeah. So I think that we can turn to poetry and literature and, you know, arts to get these metaphors that are actually life affirming. If you look at the definition of stress as being like ongoing and untreated or unintegrated physical and emotional pain, so we think, okay, so how do you treat that? How do you deal with stress? And typically, we might say, well, there's some things you could do. Crying is really important, especially if you have a compassionate witness or someone to listen or hold your hand. Mm-hmm. Laughing is really important. Anything that raises your vibration and brings you closer to joy, you know, like shaking and sweating, these are all like ways in different cultures. And so that could mean, it can mean dancing or running or going in a sweat lodge. And then I go into the earth elements, because for Indigenous people, like water is really important. And in all religions, there are rituals with water. So like the Cowichan people where I'm from, they will drive into the mountains and go cold water bathing. So if you're feeling emotional pain and you jump in a freezing cold river, all you don't think about your pain. All you think about is the sensation that the where the water meets your being and is going inside your being. And so even taking like regular showers when you're feeling down or sitting by a waterfall, there's so many ways. And then everyone tells us drink lots of water, but the idea is that it's cleansing and it cleanses out toxins, but also that our, you know, in some traditions we believe that your emotions are moved through you in water. Right. And so there's also fire. There's lots of, you know, like the rituals around the sauna or the sweat lodge, but also just like writing down things that harm you or that you want to get rid of and burning them in a fire. Like there's different ways to use these elements. And of course,
ritual.
Wind, you know, wind can cleanse things. So it's just really good to get fresh air and open your windows and clean out your house and reburn, you know, sage or sweetgrass. So these are some examples of how to work with Mother Earth in a kind of daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope that gives you a little bit of
it does. And thank you. We thank you. I think it seemed short, but I think we have nearly in 40 minutes, 45 minutes, it just flew. But I think everything you just mentioned is really helpful for our community. And of course, we'd love to continue to working with you. I know we're working with you to try to design a conference, specifically designed around earth and healing and the earth, the land itself. I mean, for our culture, the land is also something sacred. Land is not something to be sold, bought, and purchased.
Yeah.
We're working with you in order to, you know, present these commonalities between, you know, your community's approaches to healing and our community's approach to healing, and see if we can find common grounds here to build on a spirit of reciprocity, friendship, especially since we are immigrants and we are making a living on the land of First Nations people. And I think it's important to acknowledge that. And I think it's important to connect with the First Nations, with the heart and soul of this land itself. That's what makes it sacred, and, you know, it's a sacred relationship that we honor.
Yeah, I agree. It's really important to pay attention to those things and to learn about accurate history. You know, here in Montreal, annually, the Mohawk people, they get together with the Irish community. And because the Irish community want to say thank you for helping us during the potato famine when our people were dying, the Mohawk communities here, sent them resources.
Wow.
But most people don't know that. It's not part of the dominant conversation. But yeah, lots of nice things have happened. You know, my friend Vicki Reynolds was telling me that she works with a lot of folks in Vancouver, and the Chileans, when, you know, the group escaped when Pinochet was in power and they came to Canada, and they realized, like you said, that actually whose land is this? This isn't the white settlers' land. This is Indigenous land. And how can we go thank the people that we are living here? So they approach community and build relationships, and then had a ceremony to thank the Indigenous people in that area. Receiving them and providing safety, but like in a really deep way. And so these things can happen, but it means that there have to be relationships built and ongoing conversations, and just to be careful not to, you know, drain people or communities with really limited resources, that kind of thing, right?
That's right, absolutely. Well, thank you, Catherine. I don't want to hold you more because you said you have to go, but I really thank you. I think our community thanks you, and we hope to be in community with you and the people here, the communities, the First Nations here.
Oh, that's lovely.
Thank you.
Yeah.